This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, cars that go twice as far and pollute half as much. They're called hybrids and are coming on the market soon. Home Depot says it will sell certified wood, meaning lumber products from forests that are sustainably managed. Is there enough certified lumber to meet the demand? The spring emergence of the skunk cabbage inspires poetry and thoughtful reflection by Professor Richard Nunley. And on the Earth calendar, shad are migrating up the estuaries of the Atlantic coast as the water warms. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Most of us have heard about electric cars. While they're better for the environment, they're also expensive and have to be recharged every 100 miles or so. But next year, American drivers will have the option of purchasing more practical alternatives that are better for the planet and give us the freedom cars offer. Automakers in Japan recently introduced hybrid electric gasoline vehicles that combine internal combustion engines with electric drive systems and battery storage. The result is a fuel-efficient, low-emissions automobile with the look and feel of a conventional compact car. Sean Dudley has the story.
Hybrid automotive technology has been in development for some time, but now the race to bring hybrid automobiles to American markets is heating up. Both Toyota and Honda will offer their version of the hybrid vehicle to American car buyers in the automotive year 2000. Subaru is planning to enter the competition in 2001 with its hybrid version of the minivan, and American car makers are working on their own designs. Andy Boyd, spokesman for Honda of America, explains the basic idea behind the hybrid.
It uses gasoline and or traditional what we call internal combustion power and also electric energy. So it combines the two technologies to make a vehicle that's both conventional in use and at the same time has superior attributes and fuel economy and emissions.
According to Prabhakar Patil, chief engineer for hybrid technologies at Ford Motor Company, this combination of efficiency and low emissions is achieved through two basic designs now being manufactured.
One is what I call an electric hybrid or a range extender, which is really an electric vehicle. People don't like the electric vehicles of today because of their limitations on range. They are afraid of going someplace where they may not be able to charge it, or if they're charging it at home and an emergency develops, they can't get out. And so what the hybrid does is puts effectively an onboard source of electrical power, which is the IC engine, so that for most trips, you still run it as a pure electric and charge it at home overnight. But when you need to, either because you're going on a long trip or in case of an emergency, you can use the internal combustion engine to effectively have unlimited range.
The second design is most likely to be seen on American streets. It's being introduced in the form of the Toyota Prius and the Honda VV. These small, sporty coupes offer twice the fuel economy of conventional vehicles in their class.
The other type is more of what I would call a fuel economy hybrid, so primarily internal combustion engine vehicle, but you can significantly improve its fuel economy by using the electric motor because you just shut down the engine when you don't need it.
Andy Boyd from Honda explains how the VV combines gasoline and electric power in this way. The VV has a system that automatically shuts off the small IC or internal combustion engine when its power isn't needed.
Well, the electric motor in the Honda hybrid vehicle serves as a power assist, and it also is there to restart the engine so that you may have this idle shutoff feature, which again helps to save fuel. At the same time, having the electric motor there to provide additional power allows you to use a smaller displacement gasoline engine. In the case of the Honda hybrid vehicle, it's a 1-liter, three-cylinder engine, so significantly smaller than the engine you'd find in a traditional automobile. And at the same time, it has very similar performance because the electric motor provides additional power, for instance, when you're pulling out from a stoplight, climbing a hill, or making a passing maneuver, or emerging onto a freeway, that electric motor is going to kick in and act almost like a supercharger, if you will. It's going to provide additional boost to the engine so that you've got power when you need it.
Although the power plant in the VV is very different from that of a conventional car, Boyd says that overall, the hybrid automotive experience will seem familiar to American drivers. He even claims that performance will rival that of conventional cars in the same class.
For the most part, it won't seem very different. It's still primarily powered by its gasoline motor, and so it's going to feel very much like a traditional automobile. It's got what we call an idle shutoff feature. So when you're sitting at a stoplight or you're stuck in traffic, you're sitting still for any extended period of time, more than a few seconds, it shuts off the engine. And so, of course, it's going to get very quiet. And then when it comes time to move again, as soon as you put the car in gear, before you can even get to the gas pedal, the electric motor will restart the gasoline engine.
Ford's Prabhakar Patil predicts that the fuel economy hybrid will be more popular with environmentally conscious Americans likely to buy hybrid vehicles.
The second type of hybrid, the fuel economy hybrid that I mentioned, would be a primary vehicle. In fact, it would be a substitute for a normal vehicle, the big benefit being that it is considerably cleaner and, of course, gives you the significant improvement in fuel economy.
Andy Boyd says hybrids may only be the bridging technology that leads to fuel cell vehicles in the future. One way or another, he predicts the death of the internal combustion engine. I wondered, will we still be driving gasoline-powered cars in the year 2010?
In 2010, probably. In 2050, probably not. The internal combustion engine is going to maintain its dominance for probably 10 or 15 more years. If you think of the life of a vehicle is an average of 9 years. And so it's going to be quite some time before these vehicles are really out there as the dominant power plant or dominant technology.
American car makers have not announced introduction dates for any hybrid vehicles. Toyota estimates that more than 18,000 of its hybrids have been sold in Japan since 1997. But the company is losing money on every hybrid car sold. The Toyota Prius will be available in the United States by summer 2000, with an estimated sticker price in the low $20,000 range. The Honda VV, estimated to be 86% cleaner than other cars in its class, is a two-seater that gets more than 70 miles to the gallon. It will be available in late 1999. But the real question is, will Americans, spoiled by artificially low gasoline prices and obsessed by powerful automobiles and gigantic gas-guzzling sport utilities, even notice their arrival? For the Environment Show, I'm Sean Dudley.
Home Depot is claiming to be the first major home improvement retailer to commit to selling certified lumber. Just recently, the company announced it is joining the Certified Forest Products Council, an independent organization designed to help business increase sales of certified wood. Home Depot officials describe the move as a big step, but the environmentalists say it's still not enough and that the company is ignoring the big issue. Stephen Westcott explains.
Annual sales revenues for Home Depot are now about $34 billion, making the company the largest home improvement retailer in the world. Besides supplying hammers, nails, lighting fixtures, and other items, Home Depot sells a lot of wood, more than 3% of all the wood sold in the United States. Suzanne Apple, Director of Community Affairs, says the company is taking a leadership role in the home improvement industry by joining the Certified Forest Products Council.
Moving toward certification is going to help us identify what our existing sources are and how to improve the certified supply. And as part of our membership in the CFPC, we've committed to a 12 to 18-month plan that will move us toward increased supply of certification.
Certified lumber is wood that comes from forests that are managed sustainably and approved by a certifying agency. Even though Home Depot is working towards selling more certified lumber, Suzanne Apple says uncertified wood, or wood that appears on the market from all other sources, will continue to be sold.
We haven't set any targets for percentage of certified wood in our stores. We're really in the process of developing all of those kinds of goals really for internal use, because right now what we're trying to get a handle on is what is the source of the wood in our stores today, and then what's the supply of certified wood, and how do we move that move towards certified wood over a period of time.
Certified lumber can come from old-growth forests, which are forests that have never been cut before, or from second-generation forests. Some environmentalists say Home Depot's commitment to selling certified lumber is not enough, and say they want the retailer to totally stop selling lumber from old or ancient forests.
Well, the planet has already lost almost 80% of its old-growth forests. I mean, this really, on any objective analysis, is pretty much a crisis scenario. If we're going to protect the world's old-growth forests, we've definitely got to stop logging in them, and other dynamics of destruction as well, of course, cattle ranching and other things. But industrial logging is by far the major cause of destruction of old-growth forests. If we don't stop that, then no matter what we do to experiment with more sustainable management techniques in second-growth forests, we will have lost our planet's old-growth forests and all the species that inhabit them.
That's Christopher Hatch, Campaigns Director for Rainforest Action Network, an environmental group based in California. Rainforest Action is one of the groups heading the Coastal Rainforest Coalition, a cooperative effort we told you about in recent months designed to get large companies like Home Depot to phase out using wood products that come from old-growth forests. Some large companies like 3M, Nike, and IBM have joined the coalition, and while Rainforest Action Network has held protests outside Home Depot stores in an attempt to get the company to join the effort, Home Depot has not responded. Christopher Hatch says he remains cynical about the company's latest effort to phase in more certified products.
Home Depot, after getting some public heat over their wood sales in the late 80s and early 90s, in 1992 made a decision that they would phase out sales of unsustainable wood products as their contribution to ending global deforestation. Far from abiding by that policy, they've been expanding at the rate of several stores a week, and they've been ended up now, 8 years later, selling much more than twice as much old-growth wood as they were when they made the commitment to get out of it in the first place.
Home Depot officials respond by saying the program announced in 1992 was geared towards phasing out tropical hardwoods like mahogany that were being harvested in an unsustainable manner, something the company is still working on. It's estimated that a substantial amount of the wood products on the market today comes from old-growth forests. Home Depot's Suzanne Apple admits the company does not know how much old-growth wood it sells, but maintains the retailer is working with vendors to determine the source of wood in all of its stores. While environmentalists like Christopher Hatch say the company is failing to look at the big picture of old-growth deforestation, Suzanne Apple says the reverse is true. She says the company is more concerned with how lumber is harvested than simply the age of the forest.
There is a limited supply of wood that is certified. So if you were to go from one extreme to the other and try to totally convert, you could basically shut down the building industry, the construction industry in the United States today. And we are, we really think that we're taking a much more comprehensive approach to forest conservation.
New housing starts are at record highs in some parts of the country, which means there is a lot of wood being sold. While Home Depot may be selling a lot of lumber, there are many other small and mid-sized companies that can and should be selling certified lumber as well. The key to increasing certified lumber supplies may well lie in the hands of consumers who demand those products whenever they buy wood. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We'd like to hear from you. If your ideas make sense, we'll broadcast them. If they don't, we might broadcast them anyway. Telephone is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. The skunk cabbage is a harbinger of spring. Richard Nunley, professor of English at Berkshire Community College in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and a regular contributor to The Environment Show, reflects on the beauty of its form and the poetry it has inspired.
Some of the earliest greens in the spring swamp are the big, broad, shiny skunk cabbage leaves, and even earlier than the leaves, the bloom-protecting spathes of the skunk cabbage push up out of the ground, sometimes even in February or earlier. A spathe is a specialized leaf-like plant part which encloses a spadix, a rod-shaped spike covered with tiny flowerets. Calla lilies and jack-in-the-pulpits are spathes. Skunk cabbage spathes are smaller, 3 to 6 inches high and more rounded and varied in coloring. Mottled purple, brown, and greenish yellow, in Liberty Hyde Bailey's description. Thoreau took pains to notice their first appearance every year. On April 4, 1856, he described them as, quote, being lapped like tent doors. It is remarkable how completely the spadix is protected from the weather, the ample hood curved downward protectingly over it, contrived best to catch the vernal warmth and exclude the winter's cold. Up and at 'em, give it to 'em, excelsior, put it through. These are the mottos of skunk cabbage, he wrote. There is no can't or can't to them. They see over the brow of winter's hill. Perhaps skunk cabbage was already up in the swamp this February 22nd when the poet William Bronk died at his home in Hudson Falls, New York, 5 days after his 81st birthday. The New York Times called him one of the most prominent poets of his generation, and the nation once referred to him as our most significant poet. He was awarded the National Book Award in 1982 for Life Supports. For most of his life, he ran the family business in Hudson Falls, the William M. Bronk Coal and Lumber Company. One of his best-loved poems is Skunk Cabbage. Because it is soon, it has a private and quiet spring. Before the birds come, before another leaf or flower, it flowers. And bees come there and enter and leave, thick with pollen. Fetid, even in the thin chill of a wintry spring, it stinks of livingness, rawness. Its color also is of skin rubbed raw by wind, by cold, by sun, and the flesh showing through. It is the flesh responding to warmth, to sun, to the first spring. It looks like tenderness, the way it curves upward and beaks over to cover within. William Bronk, February 17, 1918, to February 22, 1999.
That was Professor Richard Dunley of Berkshire Community College. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Right now, shad are migrating up the estuaries along the Atlantic coastline of the United States to spawn. Dr. Carlton Ray is a professor of Environmental Sciences, Department of the University of Virginia, and an expert on Atlantic fish species. He describes where the shad are headed.
Any of the larger estuaries, even some of the smaller ones, they're pretty ubiquitous all the way from Florida up to southern New England. They are very wide-ranging, and what happens is as the water temperature warms gradually more southerly than northerly, it warms first in the southern regions, the shad migrate according to those temperature changes. This year has been extraordinarily warm, so they bred very early. I saw shad row in the market about 3 weeks ago.
While some fish mate internally, shad, like most fish, engage in external fertilization, according to the professor.
They simply get together in breeding swarms, almost, and lay eggs and sperm in the water together, and the water mixing of the water causes fertilization. Now, once the eggs hatch, then the larvae, after they absorb what's called a yolk sac, which is on the egg, the larvae swim into the water column and begin to eat plankton.
Professor Ray says plankton and other nutrients that shad rely on for food originate from the land. He says frequently people like to think that land and aquatic ecosystems are separate entities, but he emphasizes that the fertilizers, pesticides, and insecticides that we put on our farms, lawns, and golf courses pollute the waterways where important species like the shad spawn. Shad populations have rebounded in some areas and remain depleted in others. Overfishing, habitat loss, and pollution are major reasons for their decline. Meanwhile, young shad remain in fresh water until they're about 2 to 4 inches in length, and then they swim out to sea. This migration out of rivers and streams has actually helped some shad populations avoid becoming contaminated with PCBs and other pollutants. Professor Ray says one of the most distinguishing characteristics of the shad is the manner in which they eat.
They open their mouths and filter feed. That is, they take a lot of water into their mouths and the gills strain out the food. Now, some fishes, like herring in particular, filter feed almost exclusively. The shad, can filter feed. It can also gobble up small fish.
Unlike mammals, shad grow throughout their lifespan. At maturity, they weigh about 2 to 3 pounds, with some reaching 5 pounds. A member of the herring family, Professor Ray says shad are about 2 feet long.
They're a sort of olivaceous, bluish color, rather nondescript. They're terrific eating, incidentally. You have to watch out about the bones. Herrings have lots of bones, and it takes a lot of skill to fillet a shad, but they're absolutely wonderful eating, broiled or so forth. And the flesh is rather dark. The fish itself, well, you know what a herring looks like, I suppose. Rather not too attractive in color, I wouldn't suspect, although this can be silvery blue or grayish brown.
For hundreds of years, shad have been harvested not only for the meat, but for their eggs or roe, which many folks in the United States and other parts of the world consider a real delicacy. Shad roe is best when cooked briefly in a hot buttered frying pan and sprinkled with lemon juice. Losing your life and your eggs would make any fish depressed. Thus, we empathize with the sad shad. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we talk green about the sun. Specifically, where are we in the development of solar power, and can you make it run your electric toothbrush today? And we travel up the Irrawaddy on a riverboat, a great river whose ecological health is in the balance. Stay with us. We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be talking about the sun, which seems appropriate as the days get longer and winter comes to an end. Energy from the sun powers everything that happens on Earth. But rather than take energy from fuel like wood or oil that was created with the sun's power, we seek better ways to use the sun's energy directly. Sunshine is free, of course, and it is a substitute for fuels that cause greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. I have three guests here who are all engaged in the development and use of solar energy. They're John Thornton. He is leader of the domestic photovoltaic applications and development team at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. That's a research facility funded by the Department of Energy, and he is in Colorado. Mark Kelly is with us. He's a member of the Passive Solar Industries Council. That's an organization that advances the design of residential, institutional, and commercial buildings. And he's also president of Building Science Engineering, which is an engineering firm in Harvard, Massachusetts. Also with us is Scott Sklar. He's executive director of the Solar Energies Industry Association, and that's an association that represents the manufacturers of solar products. So to get started, John Thornton from the National Renewable Energy Lab, can you tell us or give our listeners a sense of whether we'll ever get to the point where solar energy is used to meet a substantial portion of our needs, or is it always going to be a niche market and the edge of the energy business?
Oh, I believe eventually it will become a very substantial part of our generation capacity. It probably won't ever replace all of the capacity simply because there's a lot of time factors that fit into it, but I think it'll eventually enter into our utility markets. It'll supply us a substantial amount of our least peaking power, replace a lot of the more expensive energy that's used in the United States. It'll also be used for other markets that are not quite niche, but they might be used to offset the impacts of natural disasters and other events of that nature. So I think in the future, And in not very distant future, you're going to start to see a major impact by these technologies.
Now, Mark Kelly, you're involved in solar power and in passive solar power. And for our listeners who may not understand the difference, when is solar energy passive as opposed to more aggressive?
Well, as you're aware, no doubt, about a third of all the energy, maybe 40% of all the energy used in this country, and about 70% of all the electric energy is used by buildings. So passive solar primarily relates to using solar energy in buildings, and usually through the process of designing the buildings to take advantage of a wide variety of technologies that are solar technologies, but they incorporate the building itself as part of the solar collection technology.
And this obviously is different from hanging a gadget on the roof or someplace that then takes the energy and does something with it to heat the building.
Well, that's exactly right. Although, in many senses, some of the solar collector technologies are passive. In fact, the main thrust of passive solar design is to design the building itself to collect and distribute and use solar energy.
Now, Scott Sklar, from the manufacturing end of things, what kinds of technology are your big sellers today? What is happening in the marketplace? What is being sold?
Well, in the U.S. manufacturers are exporting 70% of their solar electric technology to the developing world, which is called photovoltaics, and exporting 15% of our thermal products, primarily for heating water, overseas as well. And that's primarily to the tourism industry and the government sector. And so we are primarily an export industry now, and in the U.S., markets are beginning to evolve where utilities or local governments are concerned about clean air or reliable power. And when that happens, our technology comes into the marketplace and is cost effective.
You mentioned photovoltaics, and John Thornton, this, I guess, is part of your field of research. My recollection is that about every time I think about photovoltaics to possibly take care of our own farm, it seems like it's about 4 years away. And by photovoltaics, I assume we're talking about the stuff that you can put on your roof or whatever that makes electricity specifically. Are we any closer to having photovoltaics for home application that would make sense economically?
Yes, we are, as a matter of fact. It's there's both in the farms and ranches and in the residential market sectors, there's quite a bit of use of photovoltaics. Here in Colorado, where we live, and as well as a lot of the western United States, people are adding photovoltaics to their home as a very cost-effective measure. That doesn't necessarily mean it's cheap, but it does mean it's cost-effective compared with getting new utility service extended to your home or your farm or your ranch. The prices of conventional utility are rising substantially when you live in a remote area. And by a remote area, I mean a new subdivision or someplace like that. You'll find that the utilities are starting to charge you for extending the power line to your home. And we find generally that if you live or work or need energy anywhere more than about 1/8 to 1/4 mile from where you need the power, that photovoltaics can often be the most cost-effective way to provide that energy.
I must say, there's also something so appealing in the notion that you don't have to worry about the utility. To heck with it, I'm going to make my own. But thinking about photovoltaics in the residential application, take us away from the hypothetical. What does it look like? Are these shingles on your roof? Is this a dish? How do you make it work in a residential situation?
Oh, the photovoltaics of today vary so much from the earlier units that we put in, even as recently as 8 or 10 years ago. The units of today can be shingles on your roof that look virtually like the other shingles that are already on there. They match very closely. They can also be panels that are recessed, fit into your roof, and as Mark would say they would be integrated, where they actually become part of the roof structure themselves, and they're very aesthetic, and they actually cut the cost of the roof because they add to the strength of the roof, so this in turn cuts the cost of the photovoltaics way down.
Take us through this quickly. How does a photovoltaic shingle work?
Well, you install them on the roof just like you do normal shingles. You install a strip, and the strips tend to be about 7 feet long, and you use a sufficient number of strips to equal the size of the amount of power that you would like to have on your residence. And you simply overlap the strips like you would normal shingles. There's very little difference in the process of installing it, so a normal roofer can easily install these sorts of shingles. Once they're there in place, it's a simple affair. The sunlight strikes the surface of the shingle. It's converted to DC electricity inside the or on the semiconductor junction. That electricity then flows through wires, which go to a central point in your house where you have what they call an inverter, which changes the DC electricity into AC electricity that is compatible with the normal grid power that we use every day.
And, Scott, are you selling any of this stuff, or have you got manufacturers that are putting it on the market?
Yeah, we have a manufacturer that is mass-producing solar roofing shingles in Michigan. We have about 20 manufacturers around the country that are producing all kinds of everything from roofing slate to solar modules or panels to certain kinds of innovative siding for buildings. And we will have in the market building glass in the very near future. So whether you're a commercial entity or want your skylight to have some tinting but also can produce electricity on your house, that will be available too.
Really? So will this be like a window that you can see through it? And yet,
Well, I don't think you'll see through it. It'll be like a tinted window where you'll get light through it, but you probably won't see through it, at least the earlier versions. But it will evolve to be a see-through window as well. And that's the unique part. This industry is very much like laptop computers or cellular phones were in the 1970s. The issue is it's all economies of scale. And the technology will be growing in different innovative ways, but it's very usable now.
John, is your laboratory looking at breakthroughs in the future on this, or are we about where it's going to be for a while?
No, the breakthroughs come every day. It's interesting. We do, all of our work is closely coordinated with the industry that Scott represents, and we work very closely with manufacturers to develop both new products and then in try and enable the manufacturers to scale up the products, achieve the economy of scale so that the manufacturing costs drop and then the prices drop and they become more competitive with other options, but the breakthroughs come, I'd like to say every day. It's not quite that frequently, but
so
it's
what's coming up
times a year. There are
what's coming up next? My understanding is one of the breakthroughs was to be able to make these things more cheaply and thinner so that you could put them in shingles and stuff like that. What next?
Well, I think you're going to see some new technologies emerging, new slightly different types of photovoltaic. They're going to become much more efficient. We already have achieved some of the thin film photovoltaics are now as efficient as the older crystalline type photovoltaics and compete equally well. They're beautiful. They're aesthetic. They're deep blue or black, and they're becoming architectural elements. There's a good example of this, by the way, in a building called Four Times Square in New York City. If you look at the top floors of the building on two sides, there'll be photovoltaics integrated into the surface of the building. Why is it doing that? It's simply because now it's becoming so aesthetic that people are wanting to incorporate it into the sides of buildings
and
skylights and things.
And if I could point out, there's a perfect example where buildings pay more per square foot than photovoltaics today just to get architecturally aesthetic materials. And if they can also at the same time produce electricity to augment the power they use, that's going to be a whole new trend for green buildings.
Let me ask Mark Kelly from the Passive Solar Institute something, or Industries Council, and that is, if you're thinking about a building at this point,
Given today's economic circumstance, do you get more bang for your buck energy-wise by designing passive solar than you do by the active solar?
Well, let me just start with there are two really important aspects of the question you just asked. The first is a building uses different kinds of energy. In terms of the kinds of things that go on in a building, you have lighting, you have ventilation, you have heating, you have cooling. Some of these must be done by electricity, in which case photovoltaics are producing electricity, and that's what should be used. But some of them, like simple heating or preheating ventilation air that's going into the building, can be done with other solar technologies, which are far more cost-effective and, in fact, do the job better. As you go up the scale of trying to provide higher quality energy, higher quality meaning low temperature heat, higher temperature heat, cooling, and finally electric energy for appliances. As you go up that scale, the efficiency of the solar collection drops. So what you want to do is use the solar technology that's appropriate for the end use that the building is using. The other thing that's critical is the building itself must be designed to minimize the amount of energy it needs for all of those uses. If you want to get a very high fraction of the energy that building is using from solar technologies, the best place to start is by minimizing the amount of energy you need.
And that I presume, is insulation and
insulation,
that kind of thing.
Reducing the amount of air leakage, improving the performance of equipment, buying appliances that don't use a lot of electricity, buying high efficiency lighting products. All of those things mean that if you need much less electricity, for example, then photovoltaics are going to be providing a much higher percentage.
Let me ask you all something. The president announced a million solar roof goal in his State of the Union message this year. Is that for real?
Yes. Our industry, the solar industry, really pushed that if we were going to lead in the global markets in the near future, we needed a demonstrably growing domestic market, because we didn't want to fall into VCR syndrome where you import the very technology you created. And what the president has done is set targets for federal purchasing of solar, because I don't know if this most people know this, but the U.S. government is the largest owner of buildings in the world and the largest user of energy in the world. And so there are many, many cost-effective applications that can go in all these federal buildings and facilities. And that's moving forward. And secondly, it was challenging communities, local governments, whether they're trying to cut costs in complying with the Clean Air Act or trying to stop the floods and hurricanes and tornadoes we seem to be seeing more of, being able to be more resilient in their services. Or they're just trying to control sprawl and deal more aesthetically and get noise and other kinds of things out of the environment.
So,
and that's what's really been a real amazing part, is the number of communities, utilities, and other businesses that have come up and said, we're going to go solar.
So it sounds as though, especially if it's got the purchasing power of the federal government behind it, that indeed we will be making a major commitment in the solar direction over the next year.
Well, again, the issue has never been if, it's been when. And the other question is, and who's going to be the core manufacturer and create the most jobs?
And the people have begun to understand that this is vital to meeting environmental goals. If we're going to get anywhere in terms of, say, the Kyoto Agreement, then we have to start using other energy sources.
We've been discussing solar power and its application. My guests have been John Thornton from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, Mark Kelly from the Passive Solar Industries Council, and Scott Sklar from the Solar Energy Industries Association. If the sun shines on you, you probably have some thoughts about solar power. Share them with us. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. We hope you'll join the listeners who have written to us. It's The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org. Big rivers serve as the arteries of civilization, as a source of transport and food, as trade routes and invasion corridors. The rise and flow of their waters nurture the ecosystems that include fish and wildlife, villages and cities, and bugs and plants. While much of civilization began on riverbanks, countries have killed their rivers as they developed. Economic development brings dams, diversion of water, industrial pollution, and erosion. One mighty watercourse which has been touched by humans but not yet shackled is the Irrawaddy. It starts at the foothills of the Himalayas and runs 1,300 miles south through the heart of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. Ancient cultures built cities and thousands of pagodas along its course, places with names that sound of mystery and adventure like Mandalay and Pagan and Rangoon, grew up on its banks more than a millennium ago, but still only one bridge crosses it. As a travel corridor, the Irrawaddy is plied by grungy, two-story riverboats. The decks are open. On the upper deck, there are a few benches and chairs beneath the corrugated metal roof. Below, people sit on the deck, surrounded by baskets of food and cargo. One learns on the 15-hour boat trip downstream from Mandalay to Pagan that human activity on this river is inexorably linked to food. In January 1999, I found myself on a riverboat with Ba Win, provost of Simon's Rock College, who was born and grew up in Rangoon and is now an American citizen. Ba Win, where are we?
We're in a town called Myimu, which is about 3 hours downriver, down the Irrawaddy River from Mandalay. And it's a small provincial town. It's quite wealthy because all the agricultural produce from this area is brought here for transshipment further downriver.
And we are on a boat which makes the journey from Mandalay twice a week.
Yes.
It takes 1 day to get down to Pagan, is that correct? And two days to get back.
That's correct. It's a boat with a very shallow draft so that the boat can snuggle right up to the shore.
And the river here looks to be half a mile wide, a little wider. It looks as though the high water mark must be 10 to 12 feet above the river, and I presume that's a level that's reached during flood time.
Yes, in the monsoon, the amount of water in the river would be substantially more than what we see now.
Now we're approaching the shore, and I see a whole group of people out here. Tell us a little bit about what they're doing and why they're here.
These are vendors. Many of them have just braids upon braids of bananas. And then there are other vendors who have cooked food, fried foods mostly, and a bunch of other sweets.
And I now see a lady in front of us up to her hips in the water with a great huge thing on her head. What are all those things on that tray on her head?
Well, I'd say they're the kinds of things that we would normally see in Dunkin' Donuts. many kinds of dough that is fried, and you know, most of them appear to be sweetened with molasses. And then I see some quail eggs, and watermelons and a number of other kinds of fruits.
There is more to sustain the riverboat passenger than the food vendors who wade from shore to the side of the vessel at every stop. Here we are. We're standing on the tail of the ship, which is part of the riverboat, I should say, the flotilla, and it's called?
The Papa Win.
The Papa Win. And this is the restaurant area. There's a table that stretches across the width of the boat. There are two charcoal stoves, each about the size of a large wastebasket, about half the height, and big aluminum pots on them. The pots are covered. They're producing something that smells very good. Bawin, what is the cuisine here on the boat?
Well, we have a huge pot of rice, and then one fairly large pot of a soup that's offered to everyone with the rice. And then they also do stir-fried rice and stir-fried noodles for those who order it. And the normal cuisine would consist of either a fish curry. The fish today is shad, and Americans may be interested to know that while shad roe is also valued here, the shad fish itself is cooked until the bones become soft, rather like sardines.
While the Irrawaddy is the main artery of the country, piloting a riverboat down its course, which winds back and forth through fields of peanuts and corn, is no simple task. The untrained eye cannot make out the channel, and in many places, sand and mud bars are only a couple of feet below the surface. The riverboat captain, with 33 years of experience, talked about diminished flow in the Irrawaddy from his perch in the cramped wheelhouse above the roof of the second deck. Ba Win interpreted.
The rains account, the rains lack of it, would account for a good portion of the water being lower. But he said that more of the water from the Irrawaddy is also being diverted for irrigation uses, and that, he said, should probably account for some of the drop. And and some of the streams upriver from here may be impounded for other reasons, including perhaps the building of dams.
The captain also says that fish populations have dropped by 70% since he's been on the river. He attributes this to overfishing and the use of nets that are so fine that young fish cannot escape. And so today, Burma remains relatively isolated from the global economy by a brutal dictatorship. Its major artery, the Irrawaddy River, is showing signs of stress. The challenge is to keep the river healthy as the country struggles to join the global economy. But at the moment, it has no visible champion. If your hybrid car won't float on the Irrawaddy River and the dandelion wine tastes like skunk cabbage, you better get a copy of this program and find out what's the matter. Call 1-800-323-9262 and order show number 482. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.